Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, as happy as can be to be here with you. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Of those listening around the world, we mentioned Florida. There was a giant, really powerful storm heading towards the United States state of Florida. You may know about that because maybe they're reporting it on CNN around the world or whatnot. I don't know. But please pray for Florida because the next few hours look like they're and continuing for the next couple of days. It looks like it could be a very tough time for the great state of Florida. I think it's the Sunshine State. Is that right, Joe? Is Florida? No, we're the Sunshine State. Are we the Sunshine State, California? What's Florida? I think maybe Florida's the sunshine. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. My wife and I went out to on a
Ondo State, Nigeria, and Florida. And according to Wikipedia, South Dakota also claims to be the Sunshine State. Oh, and I want to be very kind to South Dakotans because they've been very kind to me.
Aren't they nice there in South Dakota?
You're like the snow state.
And I know why you've been to South Dakota so much. It's because Real Presence Radio, huh?
Yes, indeed.
Aren't they great?
They are incredibly gracious, yes.
Yeah, Lynn runs Real Presence Radio. They're wonderful up there.
California's the Golden State.
Oh, we're the Golden State. That's right. Yeah. So Florida's
the
Sunshine
State. Warriors.
The Golden State. Of course. Of course, Joe. Thank you so much. And the San Diego Padres, the only sports team named after Catholic priests. And and I'll say this because we're not on the air in Los Angeles. I think the Padres are going to win tonight. I think that's going to happen. I don't know. This is like a stream of consciousness right now. I'm going to go back to the show.
I like you say it right now. Yes.
Wait, do I have a tendency to wander mentally? Wait, what about baseball? Do you like
telling
baseball?
People
Wait.
That there's baseball on and they're going to be like, oh, yeah, I could be listening to that instead. No, don't listen to that.
Baseball's not better than Joe Heschmeyer. I'm not scared of no baseball. I'm scared of Major League Baseball when I got Joe Heschmeyer on with me. I mean, 888-318-7884 is the number. It's Ask Me Anything. The lines have stayed full as they do. But give it a call. We'll do our best to get you on if you can get through as folks let go of the line, as they say. That's what they used to say in the old, let the line go. Are you that old, Joe, or not that old?
I'm not. I am used to like picking up a phone like with a cord to call, but that's kind of the era of phone
where you had to stand. Are you of the generation that had to stand in the kitchen and yell someone's
exactly.
on the phone to you?
Like, exactly.
Yeah.
And like you would have siblings who'd like clearly be like breathing into the phone in another room while they're listening in on the call. Yeah. That was like back when hanging up made literal sense because you had to physically put a phone. Yeah. Anyway. We're rambling again, so let's turn to theological questions.
If you insist, Joe, we can do our jobs. Fine, that's fine. Levi is in Virginia watching on YouTube. We're glad you're here, Levi. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, everybody. Pax Christi to both of you.
Now,
hope all of you are doing well.
You said it in Latin, and so Joe's going to respond in Latin, and I'm going to respond in English. And I feel foolish whenever I do that. But
the peace of Christ be with you.
Oh, and with your spirit. Levi. Thank you very much.
Funny you guys bring up baseball. I actually put aside a baseball game to call in. So,
oh, wonderful.
There you go.
That's high praise.
So you're a little bit too cynical, Joe.
Listen, if you want to just call and make criticisms of Joe, you're welcome to do that. If you want to just run through a list of
the last caller, I was talking about how good you are. You're having a time.
No. I wouldn't want to criticize Joe Heschmeyer. After all, he's got this fantastic podcast. What is it? Shameless Popery, which you can find on YouTube. Episodes every Tuesday and Thursday.
Wow.
Wow. Somebody's getting a book before he goes. All right, Levi, we better get to a question. Go ahead and give him your question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, you're all fine. Right. We enjoyed talking
Joe,
with you.
Joe, this has to do a little bit with a video you did a couple months back called, I believe, something along the lines of a good and evil way of viewing the cross. The main criticism that you had was the idea of penal substitutionary atonement. Now, there is something – now, my question does kind of have to do with a verse that is sometimes used to say that, although I don't think it necessarily does. So in St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians in chapter 3, verse 13, he says that Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it is written, mm-hmm. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. This corresponds to a part in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 23, to be specific, that says that those who were hanged on a tree were cursed by God. How is it that we can understand Christ becoming a curse without necessarily overcorrecting and saying, oh yeah, and God was, you know, completely, you know, cursing God and leading to this kind of anti-Trinitarian view of the atonement? And, you know, how can we get this without overcorrecting? So I just want to know
that's a very good question, and I'm very glad you asked that. So the first thing is, when we talk about blessings and cursing, there's a sense in which I think we use these terms without fully understanding what we mean by them. And a blessing is, I mean, in short, like good things, and a curse is bad things. And so quite clearly, Jesus undergoes bad things. I mean, that's obviously too mild of a way of putting it, but he clearly is accursed in that sense because he's going through a terrible suffering. We often don't want to speak in that sense. I think we're uneasy. But, you know, we could talk about Job as seemingly being accursed by God. That doesn't mean he wasn't loved by God, but it does mean that God willed that he went through some hard times. And that's something that we should take very seriously. So I think there's a way people read the language of blessing and cursing, and they think that the people God blesses are the ones he loves, and the ones that he curses are the ones that he hates. And so you read something like, Jacob, have I loved? Esau, have I hated? Even there, love and hate don't work the same way that they do when we use that term in English. It's likewise when Jesus says you have to hate your father and mother to follow him. Don't literally hate your father and mother. That's actually sinful too. That rather, this is talking about blessing and cursing. It's talking about prioritization. This is talking about, you know, we could say divine predilection, but it's not talking about literal like dislike and cursing in that sense. That's the first thing. Second, there's a beautiful homily that then Cardinal Ratzinger gave on this theme in 2005. And he's looking at two lines. One is the one you mentioned from Galatians 3:13, and the other is a parallel text in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 24, in which Peter says, in his own body he brought your sins to the cross. And that gives us a hermeneutic to understand that Galatians 3:13 seems to be saying the same sort of thing, that Christ is bearing the weight of our sins. And Ratzinger says this. He says, Christ's mercy is not a grace that comes cheap, nor does it imply the trivialization of evil. Christ carries the full weight of evil and all its destructive force in his body and in his soul. He burns and transforms evil and suffering in the fire of his suffering love. The day of vindication and the year of favor converge in the Paschal mystery and the dead and risen Christ. This is the vengeance of God. He himself suffers for us in the person of his Son. So notice there, the Father isn't pitted against the Son. The vengeance of God is that Christ, who is God, takes on the full weight of sin and transforms it by his love and by his total gift to the Father. So this is, when I talk about like a good and evil way of viewing the cross, you don't want a view where the Father abandons and hates Jesus on the cross, that he turns his back on him. Because Jesus' words on the cross, even after crying out, my God, why have you abandoned me? What does he say after that? Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. That we know the Father is actually looking in love at Jesus on the cross. And Jesus tells us that he will do so in John 10. He says, for this reason, the Father loves me. No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down freely. That's what's happening. That this is something pleasing and good to God, that God the Son is carrying the full weight and burden of sin and transforming it in some way by offering this on our behalf to the Father. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So basically what you're saying is we're not saying like curses and like, you know, like, oh, God put a hex on Christ. We're right. saying that he was in a sense taking the sins of the world and being under the judgment of God, but offering it up to redeem us.
Yeah, but even when we talk about him being under the judgment of God, God is not judging the innocent as guilty so that he can judge the guilty as innocent. Mm-hmm. That would be a double injustice. Rather, on behalf of those who are guilty, Jesus pays the cost. You know, if your kids break a window, you might pay for the window to be replaced. And so if you take all the sins of the world, Jesus pays for all of those on the cross. But that's not punishing the innocent. Like when you pay for the window that your kid breaks, no one is punishing you as an innocent person. You are freely, because of your relationship, stepping into a situation that maybe your kid can't fix. And so with sin, we have a situation that we can't fix. And so Jesus freely steps into the fray there. And so, you know, if somebody else breaks your window and then their parents say, we'll cover the cost, you're not wrathful at them. You know, you're not like, I'm super mad at you for breaking the window that your kid broke. Like, that wouldn't make any sense. So I don't know. Does that help? Does that give a clearer way to think about issue?
What I was just meaning about judgment was that, you know, Christ does, you know, the cross is a condemnation.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a real sense. Divine justice is being brought about in a real sense. I don't even want to say the ledger is being balanced. The ledger is being swung in the opposite direction. Like what Christ is offering is over and above the weight of sin. He's doing something more. And so, you know, when theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas talk about like why Jesus dies on the cross, because there were easier ways he could have died for us. And we don't often think about why did he go through such a shameful and cruel kind of death. He didn't need to do that. And in the strict sense, that's true, but this was better because he's offering more. Like, he is going so far above and beyond. It's like if somebody breaks your window and gives you a Ferrari as well as a window. Like, okay, you've been more than satisfied here. And so one of the dangers of, like, the penal substitutionary view is it just sounds like the ledger is being balanced. But it's not just being balanced. Christ is overpaying tremendously. And because of that, we can call upon those kind of graces, that Christ is winning sanctifying grace for us on the cross in his humanity by paying so excessively over and above the price of sin.
Levi, thanks. That does bring us to the break. It's Ask Me Anything. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is The Tangent. Father Sam and Matt connect Catholic apologetics, theology, and prayer to sports, art, and music. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. and it's Ask Me Anything. And these Ask Me Anything, they become quite popular. When we do Ask Me Anything shows, the lines just stay full. So I do try to move quickly from caller to caller. That's when there's a lot of people on, we try to get as many on as we can. You're welcome to call. We've got 45 minutes left in the show. So we have six lines. They're all full at the moment, but they will open up as we go. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Going to James in Manila, Philippines, watching on YouTube. I believe we're used to you calling on Fridays, a Saturday morning in the Philippines. Is this the same James?
Very same James. Hi. And so yeah, I don't have work today. So
oh, you're off on a Thursday. So what is Thursday morning right now in Manila, right?
It is, yes.
Well,
is there a holiday?
I just needed some time off.
Very good.
Fair enough.
Very good.
Glad to hear you taking it.
Well, are you calling first or have you had your breakfast already, James?
I'm having breakfast right now, Si.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Well, go ahead. Well, between bites, go ahead and ask your question of Joe.
I will. So, hi, Joe. So, Catholics often explain that the seven deuterocanonical books are part of the canon because they're found in the Septuagint. With that in mind, I'm just wondering, because we use that term, right, found in the Septuagint. So with that in mind, I'm just wondering if there's any difference between the canon of the Old Testament and the actual Septuagint itself. Are we implying that, or are we saying that the deuterocanonical books are included in the Septuagint, or is there a difference between the two collections?
Oh yeah, that's a really good question, and it's a slightly complicated question, because even though we talk about the Septuagint translation, the reality is you have different collections of the biblical books. So when the Septuagint translation happens, the biblical books aren't bound together as a single book yet, because there isn't what's called a codex. The books are kept on individual scrolls. And so as a result, when you're in the era of scrolls, it can be very difficult for later researchers to say exactly which books were and weren't considered inspired by you. So imagine if you had all of the books of the Bible as separate books on your bookshelf, but you also have other books on your bookshelf. And so someone who's just coming along and can't interview you directly, like an archaeologist, would look at your bookshelf and make a guess about which books you thought were biblical and which ones you didn't think were biblical. And sometimes it'd be very clear. They might be in a different place, or there might be, some way of kind of demarcating them. And then other times it's a little less clear. So when we talk about Septuagint, there are different Greek versions where you'll get a different collection of writings, but all of them have at least some of the deuterocanonical writings. None of them match what Protestants have in their Old Testament. All of them seem to point to what's in the Catholic Old Testament. There are occasionally books that we don't accept, but that sometimes, for instance, Eastern Orthodox or Oriental Orthodox will accept. So if you're wondering why are canons different in terms of which books we accept in the Bible, some of that is based on different Greek collections. But we know that once you have codices, the plural of codex, and once you have bound books with the biblical books in them, all of them have at least some of, and I think usually at least most of, the deuterocanonical writings. And so occasionally there might be a book missing here or there, but it points in the general direction of the 73 book Bible that we have today. But it is, as you can maybe even tell from that description, a kind of messy process. So when Catholics and Protestants talk about the Hebrew canon and the Greek canon, that's really in a real way a double oversimplification of a much messier process where different people had different collections of biblical writings.
Okay, James?
Very helpful. Yeah, I'll go finish the rest of the show while having breakfast. Oh,
enjoy your
wonderful.
I'm assuming tocino maybe, or what are you having?
Oh, you know your Filipino food, Si.
You think I know? Well, bet on this. Do I know my Filipino food, or did I Google it while Joe was giving his answer? Which of those things do you think it is, James?
If you told me that Darren told you, I would have believed that. Because Darren's
You should have seen Darren's eyes kind of lit up when I said it. He's like, oh, all right.
I'll pretend I'm having Ticino now. Okay.
Okay, very good. Thanks, James. It was nice talking with you.
All right, bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, that's wild. Usually it's Friday because it's Saturday morning there that James calls. But nice talking with you, James. Emma is in Hayden, Idaho, watching on YouTube. And frankly, you never know when Emma's going to call. There is no pattern to it. Hello, Emma.
But she harangues you all the time.
I've never been harangued by you. That's a
harangue, but never harangued.
Yeah, right. Go ahead, Emma.
Okay, so I clean houses, and this gal that I clean her house, she's is it KSPS Plus, whatever it is, a traditional Catholic? Is that right?
KSPS Plus. Do we know what that is?
Are you talking about SSPX?
Oh, the SSPX.
Thank you.
Yeah, SSPX, right. Okay.
And I asked her, I saw this, it was a little disc, and it had a little etching of a flower impressed in it, and I asked her what it was, and it's a first-class Alex relic with a Vatican stamp of St. Jude, a bone fragment. And I have two friends that are traditional Catholics, and they're just hot on my heels. And I said, how did you get your hands on it? And she goes, well, when Vatican II happened, they just cleaned house. They got rid of relics and statues and just threw things out. And then she gave me a video to watch by Archbishop Lefebvre, I think is how you say his name.
Lefebvre, yeah.
Thank you, Lefebvre. Okay, thank you. I don't want to watch it without having a little bit of ammunition before, you know, I go back to clean her house on Monday.
Okay, Joe.
What's your question exactly?
Well,
did they get rid of relics?
Yes.
So not as like an institutional church. It wasn't like the Catholic Church ever said, hey, make your churches ugly and get rid of relics. That never happened. But a lot of people took the initiative. So here's one of the things the Second Vatican Council did is it revisited some things that we'd just been doing out of, you know, this is the long-standing liturgical practice that's just kind of been added on over the years. And so some of those things they wanted to simplify. And I think that's good and that's fine. And so you can find in the Vatican II document on the liturgy called Sacrosanctum Concilium calls for some liturgical change. And then this is put to a group of kind of experts to implement. And so then they try to implement it. But then on the ground, you have a lot of local parishes who decide, okay, well, if we're modernizing things, let's get rid of all this stuff. Let's get rid of the altar rail. Let's get rid of the relics. Let's get rid of all of these things. And you will look in vain to find where the church tells people to do that, because that isn't what the church said to do. And it was just people trying to really kind of modernize things on their own initiative. And what they did is, in many cases, stripped down. So the church is very clear on the good of relics. And, you know, in every altar, in every Catholic church, there's a relic in the cornerstone, or there ought to be. So this is something that we actually take very seriously. And the church has continued to speak on the good of relics. And you can find ongoing church documents. So the most recent one I know of is from 2017, an instruction from the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints called Relics in the Church, Authenticity and Preservation. So it wants to make sure that things that are being presented as relics are real, but it also wants to make sure that we're taking good care of relics. And that, in many cases, wasn't done. So, but I would put that in some categories as kind of the same thing as like shag carpet in people's houses. Yeah, it was just like bad taste in the 70s. That's not something that the Catholic Church is requiring, and in fact is not wanting you to do. You should not treat relics in a disrespectful or cavalier sort of way. So, yeah, I guess that's what I would say. You can still find lots of places with lots of relics. You can find other places that did really strip themselves of their own riches for reasons that are a little bit inscrutable.
Okay, Emma?
Okay.
That makes sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It just, I know she's just going to argue with me, but and that's what I don't want to happen.
Wait, so. Someone in the Society of St. Pius X is going to argue with you? That seems so.
Yeah.
I'm joking
she's,
around,
she's
Emma, because there's a little
creepy.
Bit of a reputation for argumentativeness.
I think what you can do, and this I would just give you this as a general rule of thumb, is if you're going to criticize Vatican II, criticize the actual document. Like, point to where in the document do you actually disagree? If the criticism is just people did stupid things in the 60s and 70s, and I'm blaming it all on Vatican II, I don't think that's a fair criticism. It'd be like blaming the Reformation on the medieval councils. Like, sometimes people disobey the church. Sometimes people don't do what they're instructed to do. Sometimes people do things on their own initiative, thinking that they're helping and they're not. And so if the criticism is with the council itself, which from a traditional understanding, the Holy Spirit's at work in, even though we don't want to say every canon of every council is infallible, the church doesn't claim that. But if you're criticizing the council itself, show me where the council itself said to do any of these things. If instead you're criticizing there were bad bishops and theologians and liturgists in the 60s, I think every Catholic kind of knows that.
Emma, you can hear the music, so that means we've got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live. Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are. But the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern.
On the next Beacon of Truth, understanding the Bible and soulful Psalm 136.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I will give you this little warning, though. The lines have just been full, so I apologize if it's hard to get through. But Joe is becoming a sage, a trusted dispenser. That's the word I was looking for, dispenser of wisdom. How does that feel, Joe?
Yeah, I know about you Californians and your dispensaries.
All right, on we go. The next question.
I don't know if it's sage, but it's some kind of plant.
Parsley, rosemary, thyme. David in Pennsylvania, watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, David. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes. Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, it's kind of light. It's kind of faint, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm not sure why it's faint. Anyway, so I guess recently I've been feeling unfulfilled in the Catholic faith, and I've started to have doubts about its legitimacy, and I've been looking into alternatives, and I've honestly been finding some attraction to Eastern traditions, with their emphasis on peace and harmony and no excessive requirements or dogma while still allowing for the existence of the supernatural.
Say that last thing again.
Convince me to stay with the Catholic faith, Joe.
Okay. Yeah, sure. I'll do my best. I would say, number one, make sure you stay on the line and get a copy of my book, Pope Peter, because the theme of that book in no small part is why be Catholic instead of some other kind of Christian. And part of the answer to that is, by asking the question, not what do I prefer, what do I find most personally fulfilling, but starting with the question of what is it Jesus desires? Because it's very clear in John 17 that Jesus prays that we'll all be one. And so if he wants his followers to all be one and not just doing their own personally fulfilling subjective thing, that he's actually wanting some kind of external as well as internal unity, then the next question should be, well, where do we find that unity? And I think the Orthodox and the Catholics both make, at least on the surface, a pretty plausible case. I would point to the fact that within Eastern Orthodoxy, there are internal schisms. So you'd have, obviously, the disagreements between the Eastern Orthodox and the Oriental Orthodox. How do I know which of those two to be if I'm going to be Orthodox? Yep.
So I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry if maybe my mic was cutting in and out. I've been considering leaving Christianity entirely.
Oh gosh. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going completely the wrong direction. I'm glad you jumped in.
I heard you saying Eastern something.
I was having a little trouble hearing you.
Okay. It was the Eastern traditions with their emphasis on peace and harmony. Honestly, those have been, in my mind, I've become a little bit maybe too open, but honestly, sure. Other traditions just seem much more appealing, simple, and fulfilling to me than Christianity now.
I taught a world religions class, and I would push back slightly. I think there's a tendency as an outsider to have a sort of grass is greener sort of perspective. And I think if you actually look at the situation on the ground in places like India or China or Southeast Asia, you'll see that it isn't simply a case where everyone's just living in some kind of peaceful utopia. And to the extent that Christianity shapes the West and Hinduism and Buddhism and et cetera shape the East, I think you see differences in terms of cultural values. Now, by no means am I exonerating Western decadence and things like post-Enlightenment sort of stuff, but you can see a lot of real good that has happened in the West due to Christianity. Nevertheless, I would say if you want to know why be Christian instead of anything else, start with the question of who is Jesus Christ and did he rise from the dead? And I think the case for that, historically speaking, overwhelmingly the clearest place to end up, where the historical evidence quite clearly points, is Jesus really did exist. He really did teach these things. He really did prophesy his own death. He really was crucified. He really did rise again from the dead. He really was seen by hundreds of people. And his early followers were so convinced of everything I just said there that they were willing to be tortured and killed for him. And I don't know a way those facts could be true without it being the case that he actually is who he said he was. And if he is who he says he was, namely God and the Messiah, then we should all be Christian. Is that a clearer kind of answer to that question?
Well, essentially, your whole premise is that was Jesus real in everything that he said? And if the answer is yes, that automatically makes Christianity the correct religion.
Well, yeah, if everything he said and did. So that includes things like the resurrection. Like, you're not going to have, you know, because when you left the Eastern teachers, you have overwhelmingly, by their own kind of version of things, sages. You have people who are wise people sharing wisdom that they've gleaned, sitting under the Bodhi tree, or sitting, you know, like, this is the wisdom of life. This is how, this is kind of the observations on life that they have. They're not claiming divine inspiration. They're not claiming some special revelation that's only available to them and not to you, overwhelmingly, right? Like, I'm speaking very broadly of a lot of different traditions. But if that's the case, you have on the one hand human wisdom, and human wisdom has a lot to offer for it. But if it's contrasted with God himself coming into the world, that doesn't mean I can't learn something from Eastern sages. I can, but if those Eastern sages contradict what God himself has said in coming into the world, I know who I should defer to. I know who's going to be right if there's a conflict.
Yeah, and I'm still a little bit unclear. I mean, I don't deny the early church, honestly. And at the end of the day, if Christianity is true, I think that Catholicism is the best candidate. And yet, I'm totally unfulfilled in the Catholic Church, 100%.
Well, could you point to, like, what it is that you feel unfulfilled by?
I guess Mass seems empty. Just prayers. God never listens. God doesn't care. I see God as just apathetic to us anymore. To me, anyway. He doesn't seem to care about me.
I'm so sorry to hear that you're going through that. That is a tremendously difficult spiritual struggle. How long has that been going on for you?
That's a good question. It's, I think, been going on for probably all of this year. Honestly, it's been I've been in a period where like
desolation, I think, is the term that you're experiencing.
Yeah, well, that I guess desolation has come more recently, but a lack of connection to God has been going on for probably a couple months now.
Without making you overshare on the air, is there something in your life you can point to that was maybe a precipitating cause?
I just wanted to get married and have kids, and God said, told me to go pound sand.
Gotcha. I'm so sorry. Yeah. That can feel very overwhelming, and I know that can feel very permanent. I was in a long-term relationship that was going to end in marriage, and it did not. I was then in seminary for 5 years, and God was not calling me to that either. And it turned out in my case, the third time was the charm. And I'm now happily married with kids, but I know what it's like to be in that place where you're trying to do what you think is the right thing and getting this strange and mysterious kind of stop sign. And what I will say to you, and you may not believe me now, but I say to someone who's been on the other side of that and kind of come through that confusion, is that when God tells you no, it's because there's a better yes for you. And you may not know what that is. And you have to, and it is very hard. It is very hard to trust it when it feels like God has just said no to this thing you obviously want and that seemed obviously good. And this is where, you know, reading something like the story of Job, where Job is just going through this very strange and mysterious suffering, and reading that with an eye towards what Job is going through, where he's got to just be saying, like, what did I possibly do? And the answer was nothing. But God was allowing him to go through this trial, knowing that in the end, Job would come out stronger for it. But that this would be very mysterious at the time. That can be something that we I think, can fruitfully read and meditate on. And then, as Bishop Robert Barron put very memorably, Christ doesn't come into the world to eliminate suffering. He enters into suffering. And so as mysterious as Job is, in some way Good Friday is mysterious as well, that Christ is allowed. I mean, think about the fact that Jesus in the garden says, you know, not my will, but yours be done. And the Father doesn't just say, don't worry about it. Don't worry about the cross. it would be easy, I think, even looking at that, to say, oh, God is so uncaring. But we know that wasn't what was going on at all, that he was caring quite deeply about this, but knew that the cross was the best way forward. And so it may be that the God who loves you deeply knows that the best way forward for you is this path that's going to have some suffering on it. But that isn't him not caring about you. As the Epistle to the Hebrews says, those who are sons, he disciplines. That, you know, a father is going to take more care in forming his sons than he will in forming his neighbor's sons. And that often means that you have to be harder with your own kids than you are with the neighbor's kids. But that's not a sign that you like your kids less than the neighbor kids. That's a sign that you love your kids more and are invested in them in a way you aren't in the neighbor kids. Does that help at all? I know you're in the middle of something, and that can be very difficult.
It kind of helps, and I've had those thoughts before. It's a good reminder. I'm not sure that it's remarkably helpful for me though today.
No, I understand. What I would recommend is reading St. Ignatius of Loyola's Rules for Discernment, because if you're going through a time of spiritual desolation, the best thing you can do is just keep on trucking and know that it will clear up, and know that millions of people have gone through that. That's not comforting, but it should at least give you some sense that, okay, well, if this is your first time grappling with a real period of darkness, a lot of people have come through it, and you've got great spiritual masters like Ignatius who make the point that you shouldn't make any major life changes at all when you're in desolation. You just keep going, unless the change is, you know, if you're in desolation because of sin, obviously, work on that. But if it's just something that God has allowed you to go through in this period of time, there's no way through it but forward. You know, there's no way through it but getting through it. And so I'd recommend Ignatius of Loyola's Rules for Discernment. And there's plenty of good books kind of on that. I know Father Timothy Gallagher has a whole series of books. And so any of those kind of books can be very helpful in making sense out of what can otherwise be a very confusing time spiritually.
David, thank you so much for the call. I'm very glad you did. Joe said he would send you a copy of Pope Peter back when he wasn't, I don't think he quite was clear on what the question was. So I still want to send it to you. But I'd like to add Father Sebastian Walsh's book, Secrets from Heaven, Hidden Treasures of Faith in the Parables and Conversations of Jesus. It's a book I love, and I hope that it will be helpful to you. Call back again. We would love to talk with you again. Right now, we have to go to the break. If you'd like those books, just hang on the line, and Edgar will get your information. Right back with more Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilina with a few words about St. Maximus the Confessor. The emperor wanted to compromise doctrine in order to make peace with heretics. It was all about politics, but Maximus the Confessor dared to oppose him and would not back down. For this, he was charged with treason and had his tongue and right hand cut off so that he could not speak or write against the emperor. His silence resounded everywhere, and truth prevailed.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are here doing a Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. Let's go to the back to the calls, Joe.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. We go to Mary in Lafayette, Louisiana, watching on YouTube. Mary, welcome to the show. Wait. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm a returning Catholic after about 40 years. And I was having a conversation. Yeah, it's good to be home. I was having a conversation with someone today about the Haitians that are in Springfield, Ohio, the big deal about that and their practices that they do. And I was told that their voodoo was carried over from Africa that was intermixed with Catholicism, and they were brought over to Haiti. That really kind of took me back a little bit, so I thought maybe Joe might have an answer for that.
Yeah, so without being able to speak to Springfield, I can speak to the Haitian voodoo question. So during the period of transatlantic slavery, you had a lot of people from Western Africa who were forcibly brought to the New World as slaves, and they ended up, in many cases, in the Caribbean. And in some cases, they were not allowed to practice their ancestral religions, which were pagan and polytheistic. And so there were cases where they would blend their own religions and the religions of other... Because if you think about the way slavery worked, you didn't have people just from one place. You had people from many different places being forcibly brought to the same location. And so you had not just like one or two different West African tribes. You had people from all over West Africa. And you have this whole a bunch of different religious groups, in other words, that are also being told they can't practice their pagan rituals. And so in many cases, they outwardly would practice Catholicism while secretly practicing pagan practices. And this was and is something the Catholic Church has had to face in Haiti. I know that this was under the reign of Papa Doc, one of the dictators of Haiti. One of the things that he kind of did to consolidate power is he did a lot of voodoo rituals and then claimed to be one of the gods or one of the kind of spirit figures associated with death. And so people didn't want to oppose him because there was enough kind of superstition around that. So this was the problem. It's like people were, in some cases, outwardly Catholic, but then keeping old pagan rituals, because in many cases they hadn't chosen Christianity freely. They'd been kind of forced into it by enslavers. So that it created this long-standing religious problem in different parts of the Caribbean, but most famously in Haiti.
Mary?
Great. Yes, that's awesome.
Okay.
Thank you so much for explaining that, Joe.
My pleasure.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for your call, Mary. We're going to go on to Pamela in Eastern Washington, watching us on YouTube. Pamela, go right ahead with your question.
Hi. I've had a dilemma for, goodness, 17 years about putting a tip to law enforcement related to an unsolved case. And the reason it's been a dilemma is I'm not an eyewitness or anything, but I'm 69 years old, and for 50 years of my adult life, I have had, I don't know what you want to call it, clairvoyant visions, like remote viewed things, know something was going to happen to a family member or a close friend and warn them. And I mean, probably at least maybe a couple incidents a year. They've all come true. So it's been like I've heard locutions when my husband was dying at home in our living room and I was 1,000 miles away. So, I mean, there was witnesses to me sharing this stuff, and it like played out within a few hours, or I found out in the morning my husband had died at home. Bottom line is I had a strange event that had nothing to do with my family or friends. The day it happened, I continually email myself so I can keep it clear in my mind, because when I told my family and friends, I was 52 years old when the event happened. It was August 11th, 2007. It was summertime in the Portland, Oregon area. I lived near there at the time. And I was traveling, like carpooling with another person from into Portland, nearby to farms where you go get produce.
Sorry, Pamela. What is the question you're asking about? I don't even know all the details.
I don't know whether I should come forward. So I had a vision of how. So the week before, I'd driven back, and there were sheriff's police cars on the highway against like a 200-foot hill. I had no idea what it was. I was someone was actually driving my car. I had a six-year-old I had adopted in the back seat, so I was attending to him. And I saw these police cars.
So again, I don't need to know later, all the details of the event. Are you just asking, should you go to the police about a locution that you had?
It wasn't a locution. I passed by it unbeknownst to myself. I was just leaning back, kind of talking to the person who was driving. And I literally, it was like a 30-second commercial played out in my head. I don't know how to explain it. Like I was looking at a video screen, and I didn't even know we were actually passing by that location. I opened my eyes because it was so weird. And I looked,
Pamela, sorry to cut you off. We don't have a lot of time, so I want to make sure Joe has enough time to answer your question. So Joe, for Pamela, what do you think she should do with this kind of information?
Yeah, I mean, by all means, if you're worried that you have knowledge of something that could be verified by the police, you can go to them. But you should know a lot of people find themselves in a similar situation. You're actually not the first person I've spoken to who thought they'd had a revelation about how to solve a case, and it typically turns out not to be anything. There's a very poor track record in terms of everything from locutions to remote viewing to psychics in terms of cracking cases. So if it's something where is weighing upon your mind and you feel like you need to talk to them to help crack the case, it's not impossible. You know, we believe that there is a spiritual realm, and it is possible you have received a revelation on this. Overwhelmingly, though, that is not the more likely outcome. But if it's something where you feel ill at ease, and unless you can share this with someone, I think you can set an appointment and use the non-emergency number to share what you believe to be the case. And then if there's a way they can investigate it and confirm or disconfirm what you believe happened, then I'm sure they'd be happy to take it from there.
Pamela, thank you so much for your question. We're going to go ahead and move on to Candace in Georgia, also watching on YouTube. Candace, we're coming up to the end, so if you can be brief, we can definitely get you an answer.
Sure. Hey, how are you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call. I am actually in the process of converting with my family in RCIA. And we come from a Reformed background, and I really struggle with penal substitution. And my journey actually started with Eastern Orthodoxy, and their view of the atonement, I really love their view of the atonement. But now that I've been convinced of Catholicism, I'm having a hard time understanding the difference between satisfaction theory, that is the Catholic tradition, and penal substitution. Can you give me what the substance, the difference in the substance is?
Yeah, and I mean, bear in mind, this is going to be, for time reasons, a little bit of a simplified view, but maybe that will be helpful. So if you think about, I used this example before, but if someone has a debt that they owe and you step in and pay the debt on their behalf, that's one thing. Another thing would be someone is on death row, and so they torture and kill you instead. We would point to that first one and say, well, the paying of a debt on behalf of someone else, that makes sense. It's not penal. You're satisfying someone else's debt, but you're not actually being punished, right? If I am paying the debt of someone who I know can't afford to, let's say you go to a restaurant and someone forgets their wallet and you say, I'll pay for you. You're not being punished in that situation at all. It's just not what's happening there. You are satisfying the debt of another, but you're not being punished. And so even though you are restoring justice through your own suffering, you're losing money, it is not a case of you being punished. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think the biggest issue I've had is it sounds the same to me as if God needs something from, to be appeased. And I'm trying to kind of understand the logic there of, is God literally being given something that was taken away from him, if that makes sense?
It makes a lot of sense. Yes and no. What I would say is there is a sense in which an injustice in the world has been brought about through sin, the original sin and all subsequent sin.
Sure.
And there's a need to make that right for the interests of justice, both in God's love of justice and on our love of justice as well. And Christ, through his self-sacrificial action and through his love, helps to set the world at right. St. Thomas Aquinas would say God could have just forgiven it as the debt holder, but it was better to bring about a situation in which he beautifully resolved the debt rather than just ignoring it.
Candace, thank you so much.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Thank you very much for your call. We're going to have to leave it right there because you hear the music. Joe Heschmeyer, thank you so much for joining me and some other person as well.
Yeah, you bet.
All right. Well, let's see if I can do it. That'll do for us. See you next time right here on Catholic Answers Live.